Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Melissa Heston is here to talk about the upcoming performance of Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time at Antioch College. In today's Politics Ohio, Emily McCord speaks with Sharon Newhart, who is challenging Congressman Mike Turner in Ohio's 10th District. We'll also give you a taste of last week's performance of Fairborn High School's 11th Hour, recorded here in our studios. Up first, the Black Box Theater on East 3rd Street in Dayton is giving residents a new look at improvisational theater and a chance to develop their own improv skills. I spoke with owner Justin Howard about his latest venture and about his early experiences acting outside the box.
It was actually really accidental. I was a resident advisor at Wittenberg University, and as a resident advisor, you get first pick of classes, so I pretty much just looked at the list and said, what's the one that fills up first? And it was improvisation for the theater. So took that and just fell in love with it. So that's really what got me into it.
All right. So what was the appeal?
I don't know. I think the freedom it gives you when you're on stage, it kind of taps into a part of me that I really enjoy when I'm able to kind of let that go. It's unscripted. It's a lot of me on stage. So I loved that. I love the comedy that it brings. I love the teamwork aspect. It helps with things like my just everyday communication, things like that too. So everything about it, just top to bottom, I loved everything about it.
So there's a pretty big scene in Chicago. Tell me a little bit about the part you played up there.
Yeah, Chicago definitely has a lot of improv. Everything from Second City, Annoyance Theater, I.O., it's kind of the hub for it. So I was actually at the I.O. Theater in Chicago, which is down in Wrigleyville. I also taught improv out in the suburbs for teens, so it was a lot of fun. Met a lot of people, got to know a lot of people in and around improv. But it also really kind of helped me understand what an improv theater could look like, and wanted to bring that back to the area I grew up in.
You talked about the freedom involved with improv, and do you have to consider yourself a free spirit to get involved in it, or does it tend to loosen up some tighter people?
I think a lot of what you do on stage ends up becoming a little bit of a representation of who you are, but I can tell you from teaching it, the people who tend to be the best at it are the people who say, I could never do that. The people who see themselves as hilarious usually have a little rougher time with it, because really improv is mostly about the story and the presentation of the character. The comedy comes out of just kind of the spontaneity that comes about. So everybody can do it. Viola Spolin, who's kind of the mother of improv, always said that anyone can improvise. It is just your capacity for experience that either needs to be expanded or contracted.
So did you come back to Dayton with the intent of opening up a theater like this?
Yeah, I've always wanted to have one. I didn't really understand what it could be like until we went to Chicago. Once we got to Chicago and got in and around improv theaters, we got to see that it doesn't need to be this big, ornate, grandiose theater. It can actually be kind of a hole in the wall. So that's what we set out to create. So yeah, when we came back to Dayton, it was definitely something that we were kind of looking around, trying to find a way to start.
And can you describe for our listeners, since it's radio, the physical attributes of your theater?
We're in the Cannery Building. We're on the ground floor of the Cannery Building on 3rd Street. It's a really neat location, a lot of up-and-coming things going on in the Cannery area. So you walk in the door, and it's black. Top to bottom, it's black. The walls are black. The ceiling's black. The carpet is mostly black. So it's not real lit up and ornate. It's very plain, very subtle. It's a big, wide-open space with a pretty basic stage. It's about 8 inches, 10 inches tall. So it's not a real big stage off the ground. It's a very intimate setting. Even though it is intimate, we don't pull people up on stage or pick someone out of the crowd and make fun of them. So it creates a really good, fun, calm atmosphere to it.
So people don't need to worry about sitting in the front row?
No, I'd rather they did. It's pretty funny. I am amazed at how people avoid the front row. It's always the last to be filled up. I've been to several stand-up comedy shows, and I think that's the fear, is that someone points at you and says, you look funny, I'll make fun of you. But no, here we don't do that at all. The only interaction we really have with the audience is we take a suggestion at the beginning of the show, and every week it varies what the suggestion is. But otherwise, you're just there to experience and see the whole thing unfold, which is really neat. If you understand that it is 100% made up, and that we on stage have no more idea of what it's going to be than you do. So it's kind of an experience that you share with the audience what this show is going to be. Every Friday night and every Saturday night, we have one show each night. Starts at 9:30. The doors open at 9. It's only $9 to get in, and it's a lot of fun. The shows last about 45 minutes to an hour.
Do you ever have lines or thoughts that you've come up with ahead of time and say, I got to wait for the opportunity to use this?
We really try to avoid that. If we're back there before the show just kind of chatting, anything that comes out of that conversation is tossed out. We don't use it. Just because I have found that if you use a line or make a joke on stage, audience is pretty smart, and they see a lot of live theater, they see a lot of television, movies. They know when it's good and when it's not. And I have found that the spontaneous line that comes out of the situation is the best one. It doesn't. I don't know if it necessarily creates this type of stuff. You can go back to the water cooler next week and repeat and get laughs. But if you were there, it just made so much sense.
So let's jump back 2 months and tell me about some of the challenges that you had starting up this venture.
You know, the space was not built out at all before we came in here. So it was a blank space. When the people who owned the building bought the building, they had not done any construction in this space. So it was plywood floors and, the backside of the neighbor's drywall. So they had to do everything from the ground up for us.
How have things gone in the 2 months that you've been open?
It's been good. We've had a fair amount of people that have come out and seen us. We have a lot of people right now that are in classes or are about to jump into classes. So about every 5 or 6 weeks, we do a free workshop to just kind of give you an idea of what learning improv is like. We have a lot of students that have just completed our level one class, some that are about to start, in fact, soon with the level one class. So every 6 weeks or so, we're trying to offer a free workshop or two that kind of just gives you an idea of what learning improv would be like. And we've just had great response from it. Everybody that's involved has just loved learning about improv.
So these run about 5 or 6 weeks?
Yeah, the classes are 6 weeks, once a week, 2 hours each time. We have four levels of classes that you can work your way through. The first level is really just kind of the basics of improv, the core stuff that you need to know to be somewhat capable on stage. And then once you move on to the level two, you actually get to choose long form or short form improv. So I have a friend of mine who owns Lofty Aspirations. She was teaching short form in the Oregon District. So she moved her stuff in here, and now we're kind of offering short and long form teaching. So you can work your way through. And if you want to be someone who performs, that's actually the route to do it. Because by the time you work your way into that fourth level class, that's kind of your performance group.
How do you think what you're doing here ties in with Dayton and other things that are going on?
I've been really amazed since we put this here, the interest that is in the arts in Dayton. Everything next door to us is Taos and K-12 and all their artistic stuff they do. But, theater arts have become really interesting in Dayton. So I think it fits in really well. It's so unique. It's something that not only does Dayton not have, but you don't find it in Cincinnati. You don't find it in Columbus. You almost have to drive to Chicago to find something like this. So I think it's kind of a cool thing that Dayton can have, something that we can be known about our arts in general, but improv slides in there perfectly.
Justin Howard with Black Box Improv Theater, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. On Friday, October 26th, in the South Gym at Antioch College, there'll be a free performance of French composer Olivier Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. The concert is funded by the Johnstone Fund for New Music as part of the Sunday at Central series. It's considered one of the most vital works of the 20th century, with messages of wartime hope and redemption. Messiaen composed most of the work while an inmate at a prisoner of war camp in Germany. Sympathetic guards gave Messiaen and his fellow prisoner musicians manuscript paper, pencils, instruments, and allowed them rehearsal time. It premiered at the camp in January of 1941 for 400 prisoners, officers, and guards. Melissa Heston is one of the performers. We talked about Messiaen's message and the upcoming concert.
We have put together an incredible group of musicians. Most are from the Columbus Symphony Orchestra. This was a wish by Zoe Johnstone, one of the funders of the work. It is her birthday year, and she wanted to do this particular quartet for the end of time and involve music and visuals and these incredible musicians. So the reason why we're doing it is a celebration as well as an incredible experience to witness these virtuosic musicians.
And let's talk about the origin of the piece.
Some of the pieces were created prior to Messiaen being captured during World War II. He created these pieces as a response to wartime, a more of a spiritual response to wartime. It creates more the atmosphere of the indomitable spirit of humanity, the deprivations of wartime. Messiaen rejected them. He rejected time, and he wanted to move the work in a more spiritual direction. And so he created this work through inspiration from the Book of Revelations as well as William Blake. So this work escapes time.
And can you tell us a little bit of Messiaen's history and how he came to his beliefs and led him to this piece?
This piece more or less came as a result of his Catholic upbringing. He's a very devout Catholic individual. He studied the Bible, and he was most fascinated by the Book of Revelations and what that told us about how we go into eternity. What is that like? What is the atmosphere like? What is that feeling, that uplifting feeling that transcends us into this feeling of eternity after we leave our mortal body and go into a place where time is no more.
And he composed much of this while he was a prisoner of war.
Yes. In World War II, the premiere was January 15th in 1941. He, by circumstance, met up with a clarinetist, Henry Akoka, who he befriended. And Henry was so insistent that he must write. You must write. You must write. This is what we do as musicians. We continue to work. Let's not let this atmosphere draw us down. Let's go above it and continue to work. So he pretty much was one of the prodders to have Messiaen compose. He also met up with a cellist, Etienne Pasquier, and he composed for him, as well as a violinist who later became an actor after he escaped. They all escaped in some way, shape, or form. So it was just an incredibly unique camp where there were actors, musicians, and lots of individuals that decided that let's do this to pass the time. Let's do this to continue our work and transcend the world around us.
So let's talk about Sunday at Central Series, which this performance is a part of.
Yes. The Johnstone Fund for New Music has been here at Antioch College for 3 years. The first year we did A Soldier's Tale, along with several members of the Columbus Symphony, which was also funded by the Johnstone Fund for New Music and part of Sunday at Central Series. It was very well attended. We hope that this will also be. Last year they did Appalachian Spring, and this year the Quartet for the End of Time.
Is there a storyline to this piece?
I think that it takes on an atmosphere more than a storyline. Certainly, the story of its creation will be interwoven, and I think that's where my role as the guard or guardian or angel comes in. But it doesn't have a linear story per se. And I think that's what the Johnstones also feel very much interested in, what people come away with it for themselves, what they hear for themselves, what they see for themselves. They want you to form your own opinion about what you just experienced and talk about it. And we will have a talk back after both performances here at Antioch College in the South Gym and at the Columbus Museum of Art.
And that's what I want to ask about, the experience that, that people are going to walk away with. It's going to be a combination of music, dance, narration.
And we'll also have a video / film backdrop that kind of will help frame the atmosphere a bit and hearken to the early 1900s, various art, contemporary artists.
Are you aware of how this piece has been perceived since, I mean, it premiered in 1941, and how has it been accepted over the years?
Over the years. I'm not the person to answer that question, but I, what I've read in Rebecca Rishkin's book, For the End of Time, The Story of the Messian Quartet, it took a while for the musicians to give it a Paris premiere outside of the camp. So a few months later, they were able to put a number of musicians together in order to perform that. It was pretty well received. And beyond that, it became actually very popular in the years following. So it's considered a masterpiece.
So this free performance of Messiaen's Quartet For the End of Time is October 26th at Antioch College South Gym. What else should we know about this?
Come with a very open mind. It's not going to be a work where all the musicians stay on the stage the entire time, and that's part of the theatricality of this particular production of the Quartet For the End of Time.
Is this a piece that changes dramatically with the folks involved, depending on what elements they choose to bring in?
Yes, and the virtuosity of it is of note. The slowness of drawing the bowstring across the strings, as slow as one can. They even say it's inhumanly slow, and that's the effect that Messiaen had wanted to get. And several musicians are very much challenged by this work, as well as the clarinetist, where the breath at some point is going to eventually run out, but you want to try to transcend that humanness. So it both becomes a physiological, psychological play.
It sounds like a very powerful piece. I want to remind people that, again, it's a free performance of Messiaen's Quartet For the End of Time, October 26th at Antioch College South Gym. And where can our listeners get more information about the event and further details?
And you can at sundayatcentral.org.
Melissa Heston, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up on the other side of this, music from 11th Hour, performed in our studios just a week ago.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and I'm joined today by Sharon Newhart. She's a Democrat, and she's running against Congressman Mike Turner for Ohio's newly formed 10th District. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin. What distinguishes you from Mike Turner?
So many things. I think that the choice between me and Mike Turner is as stark as the choice between President Obama and Mitt Romney. I believe very strongly that the Miami Valley has suffered mightily in the last 10 years while Mike Turner has been representing us in Congress, and I think it's a time for a change.
You ran for Congress in 2008 and lost to Republican Steve Austria, then for the 7th District. So why do you think this time is going to be different?
Well, this time is different because this is a brand new congressional district. With the redistricting that occurred, the Ohio legislature created this new Ohio 10th congressional district, and they put Montgomery County all back together in one district. The last time Montgomery County was together in one district, Tony Hall, who's a Democrat, represented for 24 years. So in the Ohio 10th, we have Montgomery County, Greene County, all of Greene County, and probably two-thirds of the voters in Fayette County. It's actually a district that makes a lot of sense, surprisingly so, considering how wacky a lot of the gerrymandered districts are in this state. And this is also a really interesting district now because it squarely puts Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in one congressional district, and that's a very big deal.
I'm going to want to talk about Wright-Patt in just a moment, but I do want to touch on this. The Democratic Congressional Committee had put your race as one to watch against Mike Turner. They put some money behind the campaign to do some ads, and since then they've shifted some of that money to other national races. And I wonder, does this show that there's a lack of confidence in your campaign? Why did they move the money away from your race?
We don't really know the answer to that because that is on the independent expenditure side of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and we can't talk to them. But I can tell you this. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is very interested in this race. We're still a targeted race. We talk to the people in Washington on a daily basis. They paid for a lot of our field support, so they've been a big help to us. They saw that we went up on TV early and did a lot of TV, and that could have been part of their decision too.
What about the state of your campaign finances right now? Are they in a healthy position?
When you are in the final stages, like, and we're what, two plus weeks out from this election, you're spending every dime you bring in, and you're spending it on the campaign. So that's what we're doing, and we're going to be fine till the end. Probably the day after the election, if I have 50 cents in my account, then that's 50 cents I should have spent getting out and talking to voters.
Mike Turner has served in Congress since 2003, and he's a ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee. So I wonder, how will you, if you're elected as a freshman congresswoman, wield your influence to best represent the Miami Valley?
I believe strongly that President Obama is going to be reelected in another 2 weeks, and also that Sherrod Brown is going to be reelected. When I am elected, I'm going to be the only Democratic member of Congress in entire Southwest Ohio. So I'm going to be an important team player for Ohio in Congress. I'm going to work tirelessly. And one of the things that I talk about all the time is that this isn't about Republicans or Democrats. This is about the people of the Miami Valley and the people of Ohio. It's a team effort. It's going to take all of us. I intend to work with John Boehner. I intend to work with Steve Stivers. I intend to work with Republicans throughout Ohio and Democrats to do the best job that I can for the Miami Valley.
Talking about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, as soon as this election's over, one of the big topics that we're going to have to deal with is sequestration. And these are the automatic across-the-board cuts to government expenses that was put in place in the aftermath over the fight over the debt ceiling. It could mean $500 billion in defense cuts coming our way. Your opponent, Mike Turner, says 4,000 to 5,000 jobs could be at risk. I want to start out, do you agree with that assessment?
I think thousands of jobs could be at risk if we can't avoid this fiscal cliff and we go into sequestration. That's absolutely true. Where I take issue with Mike Turner is the fact that he could have stood up and done something about it before this got to this point. And I find it so curious that he goes around and has all these hearings and talking about the effects of sequestration and asking people about it as if he doesn't know. He knows what the problem is. The problem is that he won't compromise. He and other Republican members of Congress will not compromise to avoid sequestration. The Democrats are willing to make significant, substantial cuts in the budget. He is willing to cripple Wright-Patt and put thousands of defense jobs at risk here in the Miami Valley simply because he wants to protect tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. And that is an indefensible position. He should be doing what's right for the entire Miami Valley, not just the top 1%.
I know that the deadline for this is going to happen before you're sworn in, but it still could be an issue if you were elected to Congress. You talk about working in a bipartisan fashion. Can you give me an example of something that you would be willing to compromise on in order to get something like a budget deal reached?
Sure. One of the things the president talks about is raising the taxes on the top 2% of Americans. And actually, it's not really raising the taxes. It's just letting the tax cuts expire so that the people in the top 2% of our economy pay what they did when Bill Clinton was president. Instead of saying that we're going to allow the tax cuts to expire on people making $250,000 or more, I could take that number up to $500,000 or $750,000. I mean, the people that I'm concerned about are the people like Mitt Romney, who is paying less of an effective tax rate than you are. I'm concerned about Warren Buffett, who keeps saying, I'm happy to pay more taxes. I'm a little perplexed at why Mike Turner wants to protect tax breaks for people like Paris Hilton. I think that's silly.
What about the defense cuts? Would you be willing to have some major defense cuts in place, or is it an all or nothing proposition with $500 billion defense cuts that's on the table?
Oh, no. Remember that the Defense Department has already agreed to almost $500 billion in defense cuts that are going to go into place over the next 10 years. The question is, are we going to put another $500 billion on top of that? That's the issue that's in this sequestration, this fiscal cliff problem. And I think what we need to be looking at as we look at the Defense Department after we get out of Afghanistan and we're no longer on an active war footing, I think we need to be looking at how to spend our money smartly. And frankly, spending our money smartly involves the kinds of things that we're doing at Wright-Patt.
Let's talk about Delphi for a moment. Non-union workers lost their pension during its bankruptcy after the auto bailout. What will you do to help those folks that have lost 30 to 70% of their pensions when their union colleagues were able to keep theirs?
A couple of things. First of all, I understand the need to investigate and get to the bottom of whether there was really anything wrong done in that whole process. That's fine, and I'm happy to have congressional hearings about that. But what I think Mike Turner should be focusing on is let's get those hearings, but also let's actually try to solve this problem. Let me tell you what Sherrod Brown has done. Sherrod Brown has introduced legislation into the Senate that would fix this problem and allow the Delphi salaried employees to receive 100% of their pensions. Mike Turner won't talk about that. Mike Turner should have gone immediately and introduced that bill into the House of Representatives, and he hasn't done it. I also find it curious, and maybe it's a good political strategy of his to focus on these Delphi salaried workers, because you'll remember that Mike Turner voted against the auto rescue, a rescue that saved 1 in 8 jobs in Ohio and has proven to be enormously, enormously successful at helping middle-class families and workers all throughout this country, and especially in Ohio. So if Mike Turner had had his way, nobody's pensions would have been protected. And the Delphi salary, the Delphi union, the GM union, everyone would have lost their pensions if Mike Turner had had his way.
I've been speaking with Sharon Newhart. She's running for the 10th Congressional District here in Ohio. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you, Emily. I really enjoyed it.
And join us next week. We'll be also speaking with current Congressman Mike Turner. He'll be a guest on the program.
Last Sunday, the on-air portion of WISO's Fall Fund Drive came to a close with an all-hands-on-deck extravaganza, and once again, our young friends from Fairmont High School, 11th Hour, stepped up to the mics and sang their hearts out for WISO listeners. We end today's program with a special thanks to them and to you for your support of WISO. If we missed you on the phones last week, you can still pledge online at WISO.org. Help us reach our goal of $220,000 by month's end. Thanks, and here's 11th Hour.
1, 2, 3. Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I call it a draw. Some nights I wish that my lips could build a castle. Some nights I wish they'd just fall off. But I still wake up, I still see a ghost. Oh Lord, I'm still not sure what I stand for. Lord, what do I stand for? What do I stand for? Most nights I don't know anymore. Found a martyr in my bed tonight. Stops my phone from wondering just who I am, who I am, who I am, or who am I? Well, some nights I wish that this all would end, 'cause I could use some friends for a change. But some nights I'm scared you'll forget me again. Some nights I always win, I always win.
So this is it. I sold my soul for this. Wash my hands of that for this. I miss my mom and dad.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up, the Book Nook, but here's a look at tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour with Sarah Buckingham.
This week on the Sunday Documentary Hour, an election special from the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, hosted by NPR's Scott Simon. It's Groundwork, Democracy in Action. At a time of political gridlock and polarization at the national level, Groundwork explores the tone and flavor of democratic action in towns and cities, where one's antagonist is not an opposing talking head or a politician from a state of a different color, but a neighbor. We'll visit Kodiak, Alaska, where livelihoods are threatened by ocean acidification and fishermen take steps to make their voices heard on carbon emissions. And meet the people of Caroline, New York, who are grappling with the controversial gas drilling method known as fracking. Plus, a look at how young people are engaging in politics and social action 4 years after the Obama wave. And stories about the debate over North Carolina's marriage amendment in an African-American church in Hickory, North Carolina, and the participatory budgeting experiment in Chicago's 49th Ward. That's tonight on Groundwork at 6 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.